Investors Chronicle.
Hi, and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Val Cipriani, personal finance writer at Investors Chronicle, and today I am joined by not one, but two investment managers. James Doppo is the manager of the Edinburgh Investment Trust, which many listeners will be familiar with, and the head of Lion Trust Global Fundamental. James is due to retire in February 2024 after a distinguished 36-year-long career, one of the highlights of which was co-founding Magidi Asset Management. Magidi was then acquired by Lion Trust in 2022, which still runs Edinburgh Investment Trust. Hi, James. Welcome. How are you doing?
Good to be here, Val.
When James does retire, Imran Sattar will take the reins of Edinburgh Investment Trust. Imran also joined Lion Trust as part of the acquisition of Magidi. Before joining Magidi in 2018, he was a fund manager at BlackRock and draws on more than 25 years of experience in the industry. Hi, Imran. Welcome. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Val. Thank you for having us and pleasure to be here.
My pleasure. Let's maybe start with you, James. I think the last time you came on an IC podcast was July 2021. And at the time with my colleague Alex Newman, you talked about how eventful the first 16 months after taking over Edinburgh Investment Trust had been because of COVID, of course. Since then, we have had another couple of quite intense years. So, you know, how has it been through all this? And how does it feel like to be retiring at this point with still so much uncertainty ahead of us?
Yeah, well, it's one of the great joys of investment management that actually life's never boring. You know, people talk about black swans. I think in a way that sort of exaggerates the reality. But I think, you know, the period since COVID and, you know, the teeth of COVID has really illustrated the need for a sort of flexible style. Because if you think about it, there have been lots and lots of different chapters. And I think, you know, looking back on it, the sort of flexible style which Imran and myself employ is, I think, pretty resilient to some of these types of vicissitudes that come across you. And your specific question, Val, in terms of sort of the last period since we were last on this podcast, I mean, obviously the world has become a distinctly more complicated place with obviously the sad invasion of Ukraine. You know, we've been through a period where sort of geopolitics hasn't mattered really, haven't we? And, you know, now geopolitics definitively do matter. And I think that was kind of the first phase of that. And I think there again, the portfolio proved to be relatively resilient to that because, you know, it turned out that it mattered where you got your energy from. So the international energy companies, the likes of Shell and BP did well, and Total Energies. And then obviously, you know, to, well, SDG 16, which is, you know, endeavoring to protect and create peaceful institutions, you do need a responsible defense procurement operation. And so, you know, there again, with chunky positions in the likes of BAE Systems and Thales, the portfolio did relatively well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so before we sort of move on to speaking about the portfolio, can I ask you a bit about, you know, your career in the sense that 36 years is obviously a great achievement. What are some of the things you have learned about investing in this period? You know, some of the things that maybe you wish you'd be able to tell yourself to make your life easier 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things which I've been lucky enough in my career, if I can use that word, is that, you know, I've worked with a number of people for quite a long time. And I think there's a big benefit in that, and particularly in markets where, you know, things do come across your bows, which are surprises. And to unpick the sort of rhythm of markets, I do think it helps if you have people you've worked with whose judgment you respect and trust. And, you know, I'm lucky enough on that front. I think the other things is, you know, like in life, I think companies are often in too much of a hurry. And I often think in terms of trying to invest a bit more in strategic tortoises rather than strategic hares, if you think about that sort of that parable or fable. And, you know, we've had a good illustration of that. You know, a company like Rentokil, which, you know, is a great company run by a very good chief executive, but they have made a very big acquisition and it's proving to be a little bit more complicated than they thought. Whereas a company like Ashtead, which we have in the portfolio, is just cranking out the sort of organic capex and the envelope of returns around that are a bit more predictable. So, you know, I wouldn't be didactic about that, but I do think there's something in that, you know, the strategic tortoise over the hare. I think other things I would think about, I think the IPO process has changed a lot over the years, and I think it's a little bit stacked against new buyers. I think we tend to favor buying secondhand companies, if you like. They have a bit more history. Histories, I think, are there again pretty underrated in markets. And, you know, I think demergers are actually are better than IPOs to fish for valuation opportunities. I think it's important to employ common sense. I mean, we were just chatting before doing this podcast. Imran had just been to lunch at Greggs, and you know, Greggs is a an investment in the fund. It's one we like. You know, it's got great expansion potential. But one of the things that they obviously champion is, if you like, the sort of the use of the app and the like. And Imran was talking about the pros and cons of using click and collect. So I think, you know, use common sense, try the product if you can. All these sort of things I think are so important. And read voraciously, be imaginative. Yeah, I think those are the sort of things that immediately come to mind, Val.
Quite a lot to think about. You mentioned IPOs in there, which are actually relevant to one of the things I've been wanting to talk about with you today, which is the sort of state of UK equities, if you want. You know, they have been doing fairly well this year, but in general, they are somewhat of a less loved area of the market. And the government also seems quite keen on trying to make the City of London a bit more attractive for global investors. So I think the question would be, you know, what makes you quite confident about UK equities at this point? And also, what will it take to make them attractive again?
Yeah, I think both Imran and I would agree that you've really got to sort of see things in some kind of long-term context. And I think, you know, the UK equity market has been digesting a few things. Firstly, there's been the long march of pension scheme de-risking, which has been selling UK equities. You know, when I and Imran started, we would have between 40 and 60 or plus percent in UK equities. Now, if you look at Nest, it's down at sort of, you know, 4%. These are big, big changes. Wealth managers, again, have sold down dramatically. And then obviously, you know, we've had the political ramifications which have impacted global investors' view of the UK post-Brexit. So those are sort of important things which the market has had to absorb. But, you know, I'd say to listeners that, you know, markets are about rates of change. And, you know, I genuinely believe that actually compared to, let's say we were doing this podcast, you know, a year ago, it would have felt pretty odd because we had things like Trussonomics and the like coming through. Now, actually, the news is, you know, it's a lot better. It's not perfect, but, you know, we've had our, if you like, sort of flirtation with sort of political extremes, both on the left and the right, if I can sort of tiptoe gently into sort of political chat, which I think is important. Policies now, basically on both of the major parties, are relatively centrist. We've got the advent of disinflation, which is good. We might be close to sort of peak rates. The ONS revision on UK growth, you know, puts us back in the pack. So, you know, the growth angle is sort of okay. And I think the two more powerful forces, which I sort of talk about really, are firstly, valuation. You know, valuation is standout cheap. If you sort of look at perhaps, you know, the likes of Goldman or others, you can see that our free cash flow in the UK equity market, and even if you adjust for the fact that we've got sort of international energy companies and the like, it's still standout. And also a lot of that's coming back in dividends and buybacks. And, you know, one of the things I've certainly learned that while sometimes you have to be patient, in the end, valuation trumps all things. So, you know, it feels, well, it seems just on valuation terms that the UK should be due, you know, a relatively good period.
Mm-mm. So some cautious optimism there, things getting better, hopefully. Yeah. Let's, I would say, move on to talk about the trust a little bit. So many of our listeners will be familiar with Edinburgh Investment Trust, but just to recap super briefly, it's a roughly 1.2 billion investment trust that invests in a portfolio of 40 to 50 stocks, mostly UK equities, with the option to go international for a relatively small portion of the portfolio. And as of September, three quarters of the portfolio was in the FTSE 100, about 15% in the FTSE 250, and about 8% outside the UK. So the trust is going through quite a significant transition in terms of management. Imran, I'm coming to you with this because, correct me if I'm wrong, you have just been appointed deputy manager, replacing Chris Field, who is also retiring, and then you will become manager when James retires in February next year. So obviously, I mean, investors tend to get been nervous even when just one fund manager retires, never mind two. And it must be, I guess, quite a steep learning curve. So I'd like to ask you, you know, how you're approaching this and how you're ensuring that the sort of transition runs quite smoothly.
Of course, Val. Well, look, firstly, to say that I'm hugely excited about taking the lead on the trust early next year. But I'm very much supported by the wider Lion Trust team. That is unchanged. You know, the investment process that has served the trust so well over the last 3.5 years is absolutely unchanged. And also, James earlier talked about having a pragmatic, a flexible investment philosophy and process. And I'm very much of that school of thought. So there are more similarities than differences between James and I. Of course, as you know, James and I have worked together for a very good number of years, you know, since 1997. And you know, we've very much been bottom-up stock pickers. So that's the focus. That's not changing. And I guess I'm also in the very fortunate position that I inherit a well-set portfolio. Thank you, James. You know, it's performed really well, and it's full of advantaged businesses. You know, overall, expect modest change in the portfolio, very much stock-specific. Don't expect the portfolio construct, the overall shape of the portfolio, to change very much.
Mm. And can you tell us a bit more about what, you know, that approach, that flexible approach looks like? What does it mean? How do you pick stocks?
You know, at the kind of very heart of the investment process is that bottom-up focus. You mentioned it earlier, Val. You know, we're looking to build a portfolio of 40 to 50 positions in the trust. And yet, each of those positions has an attractive total return characteristic. You know, that is, you know, the combination of some income plus capital growth. So what do we look for companies? Well, typically, we're looking for businesses that have an edge. I know that's a really good starting point. Ideally, in industries that are, you know, that have somewhat of a tailwind rather than a headwind. Again, that helps. And ideally, businesses that have strong balance sheets. I think, firstly, that provides resilience to the portfolio. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it also provides good optionality for clever management teams to add value. You know, James talked earlier about Ashtead. You know, it's that very strong market position, the strong balance sheet allows them to outspend the competition by a country mile. You know, that's genuine value add. And perhaps if I kind of bring it to life with a couple of examples, you know, Haleon is a consumer healthcare business. It's a 2.5% position in the trust. It's an example of an advantaged business in a industry that has tailwinds. It has fabulous brands, you know, be it Sensodyne and Corsadil, in oral care, Centrum, that fantastic multivitamin brand, and Advil and Voltron in pain relief. You know, these are world-class brands that are set to take market share in our view. So we like the growth there. We like the margins. We like the returns of the business. The cash generation is really strong, but we think there's more to come. And finally, I just say, you know, reiterate what James said earlier about demerger processes. I think it's another edge that we have on Haleon. You know, it was spun out from GlaxoSmithKline around 18 months ago. We believe it's been unloved and undermanaged. And that's an opportunity in terms of improving the commercial execution and the innovation, which is a key driver of growth.
Let's take a better look at the portfolio then, since you've started talking about, you know, a few companies. I think, you know, one of the things we mentioned it at the beginning is the sort of economic outlook for the UK, which has been getting a bit better, but we might still facing, at the very least, a period of stagnation, which in the long term does not, you know, is not necessarily better than a recession. So, you know, how is the portfolio positioned for that kind of situation? Because you do, I think, have a few cyclical stocks as well.
Yeah, so the way we endeavor to layer the portfolio is, if you like, is obviously looking to choose the 40 to 50 stocks, but maybe thinking them in terms of a number of different themes. And, you know, firstly, Val, you know, you talked about, you know, the starting assumption of the UK economy, you know, producing relatively lackluster growth. And, you know, arguably that's difficult to argue strongly against. But, you know, the interesting thing about that, I think, is that against that background, actually, if you are a well-financed number one or number two in an industry, it's not that bad a environment to be trying to grow. And, you know, if I think about the likes of Whitbread, which is a, you know, decent sized holding in the trust, you know, they produced results last week. And, you know, if you look at that, it was very interesting because, you know, relative to what they were doing pre-COVID, and this is a key metric, I think, when looking at companies, is, you know, is there clear blue water between the 2019 and now? And in Whitbread's case, there definitively is. You know, Whitbread, as you know, is a vertically integrated business, so that means it doesn't really or rarely gives money away to the booking agencies. You have to go direct. And if you think about its competitive set, you know, it is the franchise operators who pay away a chunk. It's Travelodge, which is geared to the hilt, and it's the independents, many of which have had a bit of a nightmare. If you think about the period of COVID, you know, it was you're closing, you're opening, you're closing. Then you've got problems with labor scheduling. Then you've got your electricity bill doing a moonshot. All these things are a real nightmare for the competition. Whereas Whitbread actually well-financed, able to expand still. And, you know, the killer stat I thought, which came across from the results 2 weeks ago, was actually that supply and pricing and markets are about supply and demand. Supply is not going to reach the 2019 levels till 2028. And against that backdrop, Whitbread is going to look to expand 50% its rooms. And its return on capital, which is a key metric that both Imran and I, you know, really lap up. Return on capital is moving from a sort of 12% plateau in the previous decade to 14.9%, so definitively stepping up. And I think that's a microcosm, dare I say, of what many companies are capable of with a sort of in a relatively low growth environment, which, you know, is not a bad starting assumption, frankly.
Yeah, so it's not just all about that. You mentioned return on capital there. What are some of the metrics you like looking at in your, you know, in your portfolio companies? Some of the ones that you like most to follow?
Yeah, so it would be a mix, and it would depend on the company you're looking at. But I mean, in essence, it's metrics like free cash flow, return on capital, invested capital, and then it's the more simple metrics such as PE and yields. It's definitely a mix and a jigsaw. But what I'd also say is, you know, those metrics are great, but you've also got to move away from a spreadsheet and think about other things like how a company's profits fit into society, things like net promoter scores, all these things. You've really got to use all the data you can to put the jigsaw together.
Which is actually a good way to kind of like introduce a company that is in your portfolio and I would like to ask you about, because I know quite a few of our readers and listeners do have it, and that's M&S. M&S obviously had a very good year. The share price, I think it's up something like 100% on a 1 year basis. And I think you've had added to it recently as well. It feels like management has been making quite good progress in sort of modernizing the business. You know, where do you see it going? Is these sort of optimism justified?
I think it is justified. I think, again, if we look back in over a longer time frame, M&S has been an also-ran company for a long period. You know, Sir Philip Green tilted it, effectively it missed the internet boom and the like. And what they've done under the relatively new chairperson Archie Norman is they've made some tough choices, frankly, and I'd contrast that with perhaps, you know, John Lewis. So John Lewis perhaps hasn't made the tough choices. So what they've done is their store portfolio hadn't been modernized, so they've decided to recycle their store portfolio, and that is very, very powerful, because what you do is you increase the productive capacity of your assets. So coming back to what we were talking about, return on capital, you know, by closing a store and opening a better store in the same area, you are genuinely massively improving the profitability from that catchment area. So that is the first thing they've done. The second thing they've done, and I think it was probably arguably helped by COVID, is all the sort of grey areas and decision-making were pushed to one side. They had to get their online offer in clothing up and running. They did that, and that is doing well. I think they've also had something of a cultural change in terms of design and the like, in terms of clothing and home. The style metrics and the like are all a lot better, and that's evidence in the sales rate that they're making on full-price merchandise, okay? And, you know, I think the fact that, let's say, Sienna Miller is now, you know, championing their adverts. I mean, the sort of thing which would never have happened 3-4 years ago, which shows that perhaps their style metrics, it's a bit like talking about politics, me talking about style, but there we go. You know, it seems like it is improving. And then obviously on the food side, what they've done is they've reinvested in price using Remarksable Value and the like. And that has stimulated volume. So in both their main operations, they are growing share and putting more and better productive capacity down. And the one thing, you know, coming back to your first question, Val, on lessons, what I've learned is in terms of retailers, when a retailer gets on a virtuous circle, you've just got to hang on for the ride. And, you know, in the short term, yes, September weather wasn't great, but, you know, the weather at some point will get cold and they'll sell a lot of knitwear. And I think this is a business that has momentum, big cultural change, and I think it's one to hang on.
Okay, so a bit of hype, but perhaps justified. Let's go to another one of your, I'm going to say bet, in the sense, a company that you've got quite a bit of exposure to compared to the index, but that is having instead quite a few difficult months, and that's NatWest. So obviously part of it was because of the sort of change in management, the whole sort of Coutts debacle. And then I think there are some questions about how it will fare depending on what happens to interest rates. So again, how do you feel about all of that?
Well, you're right to say NatWest in this most recent period has been a soggy share price, along with a number of the UK orientated banks. And, you know, the big picture, yes, there's been some specific news on Coutts and the like, and obviously there's been a change of management that's resulted from that. But the bigger picture is obviously there's been a lot of competition for deposits. And also the FCA, you know, rightly has argued that banks need to make sure as part of consumer duty that actually depositors are offered a fair return. So we've seen a big repricing and a bit of competition, obviously, for deposits. That's evidenced in particularly in Barclays results. And, you know, that has led to, you know, gentle downgrades to what is called the net interest margin. But I think, you know, taking a step back, the sort of bigger feature is that what UK banks do is they hedge forward. And this is something that, if you like, is something that's going to come. It's going to be a gift that's going to keep giving this hedge over the next few years. And so gives shareholders, I think, in NatWest some assurance that actually the earnings power over the next few plus years will be reasonably good compared to where the valuation is. Obviously, now it's trading at about 60% of book. The profits that it produces are in the main distributable, which is good. So you're going to see a good yield, and also you're going to see a buyback. So, you know, yes, you're right. The shares have been soggy, but now is not the time to lose the faith on this one.
And actually, speaking of losing faith in companies, you know, when does that happen? In the sense, you know, what are the kind of things that can push you to sell a company?
Yeah, well, I sort of think often as a sort of jigsaw, effectively. You know, obviously running a portfolio, we've got a one's running a collection and one needs to feel very strongly about this. And at any point in time, there's a sort of, there's tension for capital. I would say that, I mean, to illustrate how we funded Haleon, for example, which Imran chatted about earlier, you know, that was funded by the sale of Reckitt's, which have produced results today. And, you know, I think if I was to contrast the quality of results of the two, you know, Haleon is a business that is producing a good mix in its sales between volume and price, both positive, and also has white space to expand into. Whereas Reckitt's is actually producing negative volume, some 4%, and price of 7. So that balance isn't perfect. So it's very difficult to generalize, Val, and sort of what drives a sell decision. But, you know, the quality of the earnings is what Imran and I are always looking at. The quality of earnings, the quality of the market positions, and the growth potential. And in the case of Reckitt's, it didn't cut the mustard.
How do valuations sort of enter into that? Because I think I was looking, you know, at your annual report, and for example, you know, you sold Diageo last year on the grounds that the share price was fully capturing its future prospects. And I was wondering, you know, how do you sort of decide that, say, this is a good business, but maybe that's it?
Yeah. Well, a colleague of mine did some fantastic work on this. And, you know, Diageo, again, if we take a long-term perspective, what Diageo has done is, it's in terms of market shares, it's kind of walked on water in the US for the last decade. You know, most of its brands have gained share. But if you think back to the GFC, the global financial crisis, that was the last time we saw down trading in the States. And Diageo's profits were sort of hit. So the engine of their growth, the last time it misfired was sort of the GFC. Then if you think about what happened in COVID, in the States, people were given these stimulus checks, the stim checks. And a portion of that leaked into trading up in spirits, it leaked into some other areas. So it was just a judgment that when we were looking at US results, and we're lucky to have a, you know, a good global team at Lion Trust, the balance of probability was that Diageo's sales was going to slow as the uptrading that they'd benefited, so the positive mix may have gone into reverse. Elements of that came true, and the shares came off quite a bit from, you know, the sort of 37 level to the £31 level. So, you know, it's an illustration, I think, again, of what I was saying earlier about this sort of jigsaw. One's never absolutely sure what's going to happen. These things are about a balance of risk and reward.
Yeah, many moving parts as well. What about in terms of companies you've bought recently? Any, you know, particular example?
So we talked a bit about Haleon, for example. Another which we bought is Admiral. So Admiral, as you know, is motor and household insurer, mainly motor. And I think it speaks to one of the sort of angles which you've really got to nail now in stock selection, which is, you know, the use of data. Because insurance is a fiendishly difficult industry, and you really got to, with very few data points, appraise a customer. And Admiral does that in a way that very few in the UK is able to. So, for example, if you look at Admiral's results versus Direct Line, it's chalk and cheese, effectively. Direct Line has really struggled to navigate this increase in cost inflation, claims inflation that the whole industry has seen, whereas actually Admiral has navigated that well. It's ahead of the curve. And now we're past the nadir in pricing. Actually, Admiral is going to be into the sunny uplands of earnings recovery. So that is one that we bought and we think is in the early stages of doing, you know, pretty well, frankly.
Okay. I think almost at the end here, but Imran, if I can come back to you to kind of like finish things, what do you think 2024 is going to be like?
Well, you know, it's very important to understand that the focus for us is very much on the bottom-up stock picking. That's where the confidence comes from. You know, yes, James has done a fabulous job for the trust over the last 3.5 years. And, you know, I'm essentially pursuing the same strategy, which is to focus on bottom-up stock picking. So, you know, we really need to make sure that the performance is repeatable going forward. And that just comes back down to having a strong investment process, one that is flexible and pragmatic to cope with, you know, some of the things that James talked about. You know, it is our job to deal with the black swan events. And who knows what 24 brings. But I'd say the first thing is that we're likely to be in an environment where interest rates are stable, broadly stable. You know, we've been in a strongly rising interest rate environment. I think in 24, the consumer will have lapped much of the inflation-induced increases in cost, you know, that cost of living crisis. And so the view would be that 24 is, you know, a year where, you know, there's a period of stability, and that how you make money in that market is through stock picking, through owning the businesses that will grow earnings, whatever the economic weather. You know, that's, you know, a much harder call. You know, what does the temperature look like in 24? But our focus is very much on building a portfolio that can withstand a tough macroeconomic picture and grow earnings because of, you know, having a competitively advantaged position, and, you know, companies run by smart management teams that will grow revenues, profits, and cash flow. That, you know, that's where the focus is.
And I know it is partly a matter for the board, but what do you think of the discount of the trust in this sort of environment? Do you think, you know, it will be like this kind of more stable environment will help it close it?
Well, we're both wanting to plunge in on there, because actually we both feel very, very strongly on that. So maybe I just have my tuppenny worth on this. I mean, I just think it speaks to the joy, in a way, of investment trusts. You know, here we have the UK equity market, which, you know, I think if you look at those metrics, free cash flow, the like, you know, is standout cheap. And the joy of the Edinburgh Investment Trust at the moment is that it trades at a 9% discount. So actually, in a way, you have this double discount, which I think is compelling.
Sure, we will have to see what it will take for all the discounts in the investment trust sector to close, but we remain very hopeful. Cool. Okay, this is all we have time for today, I think. Thank you very much, James. Thank you, Imran. And thank you for listening.